Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really delighted to be here, and I'm sorry to miss my dear friend Laurel last night, but I'll listen to the tape on the way home. And it's really exciting to be here, because frequently I go to conferences and there's one or two people I don't know, but everybody who's speaking at this conference is someone I know and love and respect very, very much. And I guess I've known Laurel longer than any of the others, because I saw her when she was still shaking. And but my friend Bob and Scott and Linda and my lovely wife Julia, it's just very, very special to be here, and I really want to thank you. I also, not to be maudlin, but I also want to extend my sympathies to you, because Michelle was telling me how very, very much the space program means to you, and I know what a horrible tragedy occurred last Saturday, and I really want to extend my heartfelt and sincere wish for healing. It's just shocking and difficult for all of us. You know, I've often thought, I happen to love the United States. I hope there's nobody here from France, because I tend to get patriotic from time to time. But I didn't hear, Pat didn't mention France, so she didn't mention North Carolina either, but that's okay. I thought about it, and, 2 days before 9/11, I did a workshop in up in New Jersey, in Newark, New Jersey, and flew home, and then that horrible tragedy happened, and the following Friday, I flew to Texas, to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, and I spoke at a quarterly, an area assembly, at the American Airlines Training Center, and there was, as you can imagine, a tremendous pall over the thing. And you know, times like that is when I think about how grateful I am to be an American. You know, I don't think Alcoholics Anonymous could have happened anyplace else. It works everywhere, but I don't think it could have happened anyplace but this country, because, you know, this is a country that that admits its mistakes and makes amends and changes. And, you know, there's a power and a spirit in this country that I think necessitated that God would pick here in 1935 for that magnificent gift, that I wouldn't be here, and so many of us wouldn't be here were it not delivered. You know, I was talking to some fellows in the halfway house a couple days ago, and we were talking, and I was telling them that, you know, for thousands of years, people who talk to people like me, alcoholics, would always say, look, you're tough, you got a lot of willpower, you're strong, just don't drink. And, you know, that was the answer for thousands of years, that was the answer. And then 1935, somebody realized that, and that somebody, of course, was Dr. Bob and Bill. They realized that, of course, you can't tell an alcoholic not to drink. And the book's very specific, that there is one who has all power, that one is God, may you find him now. And being tough, being strong, being smart, knowing about alcoholism, none of that has anything to do with not drinking. What has to do with not drinking is seeking the power that keeps me from drinking, and that's a power greater than myself. I can't not drink. That's all there is to it. I always think of, I always think, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I think what being an alcoholic means is that I must drink again, okay? Because forever, alcoholics had to drink again. And so I must drink again, unless there's a miracle, and you're it. You're my miracle. You're the reason that I've not found it necessary to take a drink since May the 13th, 1973, 3 days before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and met you. And I didn't know you existed. I knew you used to exist, and I knew you were a religious organization. And with the advances in science, we no longer needed that sort of thing. Michelle and I were talking earlier, and I was one of these people who came to AA. I was religiously anti-religious, you know the kind. And I sat around just waiting to be offended. And and I'll tell you, I was. And some of you didn't care. You didn't care that my feelings were hurt. But I've gotten over it. You know, I particularly didn't like organized religion. And I figured out, I did an inventory, and I figured out why I don't like organized religion, or didn't like organized religion. I didn't like organized religion because I wasn't a pope. If I'd have been a pope, I would have loved organized religion. And you know, I was born in a small town in Ohio, and I'm not from the deep south like Pat. And I'm the eldest son and second child in a family of 11 children, and I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say anymore. And I would have told you that I was born and raised in poverty, and of course I'd have been wrong about that too. Now, it's true that we had absolutely no excess material goods. I can promise you that. But I certainly was not raised in poverty, because I had a mother who every day I let her would hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And I had a father who every day I let him would spend time with me. And so I was fabulously wealthy. But of course, I had this thing going on inside of me that needed a drink from very early on. And I didn't know what it was. And, you know, I didn't know what fear was because I lived in it constantly. I had a computer that was always going. My mind was always working. I was always trying to assess what was going on around me and trying to figure out how I can look like I fit in somehow. And the brain was just always running 100 miles an hour. And what I really was terrified. And I didn't know it because I thought everybody felt like I did. And even as a little kid, I had something lived under my bed, you know, and I knew what it was there for. Just waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. Nice history. I knew that. And I could just see it. I could just see it. You know, one day everybody would be having breakfast and they'd say, "Where's Keith?" Oh, no, the thing under the bed got him. And I could put my little ear against a mattress and I could hear it moving around down there. You know, and that's just the way I lived. And I also had a horrible speech impediment, and no one could understand me except the people who loved me, and it was a really, really bad speech impediment. And I remember I was so well loved, but I didn't experience it as love. It's amazing. I had this ability to always see what was wrong. I used to call myself a problem solver. I wasn't a problem solver. I was a problem finder. I never solved anything unless I could drink or run away. But even as a little kid, I always saw what was wrong. You know, we didn't have a car. We didn't have a television set. You know, if we had a car and a television set, my life would have been complete. Now, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. Television was invented. We just didn't have one, okay? Thought I'd get that straight. And that was it. I was always seeing what was wrong with life and the world and the people around me embarrassment at poverty and all that nonsense. It was all crazy. It was just insane. And you know, I sensed when I went to make amends to my brothers and sisters after I got sober, I began to talk to them about how we grew up. They didn't see it that way. You know, my brother, Dumb Denny, for example, I went to make amends... I went to make amends to Dumb Denny. He's a year younger than I am, and he was living up in New Jersey at the time because he had to. And I said to him, I said, "Yeah, remember the nuns? Remember they used to hit our knuckles with a ruler?" And it had to be worse for me because I was a victim, so they used a centimeter side on my knuckles. He said, "Yeah, you know," he said, "I seem to remember that happening once or twice." He said, "But mostly," he said, "I remember dedicated women who spent their whole lives teaching little children." I said, "Well, that's one way to look at it." I don't know what was wrong with these people I grew up with. They never saw reality. I had my first drink. I think it's important to talk about your first drink. You know, if you haven't had your first drink, you're not going to do well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you, I've seen a few people that I wonder about, but So everybody works their own program. But I had my first drink when I was five. I was home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. And it was myself and my father and my brother, Dumb Denny. He was four. And my mom was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something. And Dad was watching us, and I guess he thought it'd be funny. He rarely was there alcohol around our house, because both of my parents had parents who could have filled a chair here. But rarely was there alcohol around our house, but there were some beers in the refrigerator, and I guess Dad just thought it'd be funny. And he got me a beer, and he got a beer, and he gave one to Dumb Denny. And I remember we drank them out of little jelly glasses. Remember the jelly glasses with the cartoon characters on them, you know? Mine was Superman. I don't know if that's significant, but you know. Psychologists would probably think so. And I'll tell you, I drank that whole beer and nothing happened. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He slid out of the chair and he's rolling around under the table and he's singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my dad panicked and he wrestled him to the ground and he got his clothes off and put his jammies on and he took them up and put them in his bed. And he said, son, go to bed and don't tell your mother about this and I'll take you to the movies. Well, I was game. You know, they don't negotiate a lot with you when you're five. But Denny wasn't hearing it. He's having the time of his life. He was singing and carrying on and just having a great time. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, little Denny stood up in his crib and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, Denny never made it. He just never seemed to develop. It's a sad story, but I'll tell you some of the odd things he did. Okay, he grew up and he went to one college. It gets worse. He had one major, and he graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing. Graduating in 4 years, you know. He went to one graduate school, and he graduated first in his class, and he was offered seven or eight jobs, and he took one. You know? And he just retired a few years ago. He's a vice president at a large international corporation, and the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. You know? Thank you. I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on a bedroom floor for the first time. So. You know, I was... I desperately needed to be liked. And I remember I was in the first grade, and my mother told me I could sing real good. She said I was a real good singer. You imagine a kid with a speech impediment. It's just a... probably going to grow up and be a baritone or something, but the little nun asked us in the first grade, and all the parents were there, and they said, does anybody here know how to sing a song? Well, I put up my hand, and my mother immediately began to drift to the back of the parental crowd, and I got up and I belted out that old favorite, I'm a gand old fag, I'm a high fine fag, and My mother was so moved she cried, and then you know I tried desperately to be good, and I was never very good at being good. I was sort of semi good, so I got into high school and I figured, well, if I can't be good, I had an older sister, which is like having a plague, she was first in her class, and you know all that stuff, a brown nose, you know the kind, And so by the time I got to the nun she was finished with, they expected something out of me, and I just couldn't deliver. So I decided I was going to be bad. So I set out on a life of crime. I formed my very own gang. It was hard to come up with a name for a gang, so we're studying history, and we studied about the great composer Wolfgang Mozart. So I formed Mozart's Wolfgang, and I was Mozart, and we couldn't afford black leather jackets, which was a thing back then, and so we bought black nylon jackets, and we pulled our first job. We were sophomores in high school. We pulled our first job. We stole a watermelon from the man who sold us cigarettes every morning before we went to school, and during the course of the day, all six of us snuck over and paid for the watermelon, and so we were just terrible criminals, and I did, though, get into a fair amount of mischief, and when you got into trouble at the high school I went to, you had to do detention with Sister Victoria, okay, and Sister Victoria was the librarian, and she was an odd old duck. I mean, she really was. She'd say odd things like, every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king. Isn't that odd? And so we'd run around calling each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary, and you know, and if you got in trouble and you had to do detention, you did detention with Sister Victoria, and what she had you do was make rosary beads, okay? And those are things that Catholics pray on, you know, and they're, this, your standard bead, rosary bead, has 10 beads in each decade, and I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and they take these rosary beads after you make them, and they'd send them to the missions all over the world. And I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria because I seemed to have an adjustment problem. If we'd have had any money, I think I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. You know, we were poor, so I was just another punk. So I'm in there making these rosary beads. Now, she'd put me behind a magazine rack. She said I was her prince, but I was contagious. So she put me behind a magazine rack, and I'm making these rosary beads. And mine were different. Your standard average rosary bead has 10 beads in every decade, and I made them with 11 beads in every decade. And so after 4 years, you know, there are like hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And she never caught on, you know. And, you know, I couldn't leave without her knowing. It would be like I wasted 4 years of my life or something. And so just before I graduated, I went to her and I said, Sister, you know what I've been doing? And she said, yes, you sly little prince. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest idea why I do this thing. And she said, people all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? It's funny. I looked in my annual, you know, and, you know, that the place where everybody writes all those things that aren't true about you. And Sister Victoria signed it, and I treasure it. She said, friends at last. Love, Sister Victoria. But then she did something that terrified me. She took both of my hands in her hands, and she looked me in the eye. You know, she was an eye person. I'm a shoe person. I look at shoes, but she was an eye person. And she said, you're a very special child of God. And she said, one day God's going to use you to go all over the world and tell his children how very much he loves them. And I was terrified, just terrified. So, in honor of Sister Victoria, God really does love you. I graduated, much to everyone's surprise, and I didn't know what to do. And it seemed to me everybody knew what they were going to do, and I was the only one who didn't. So I knew I had to go away, because if you went away, they'd think you were doing what it is you're going to do. And back then, you either went to college, and that wasn't in the cards. My sister, Patty, was already in college, and my brother, Dumb Denny, had a rheumatic heart, and it was very clear that he was going to have to go to college. And so I joined the service. Now, back then, all men went to the service, or almost all men did. You know, it wasn't if, it was where and when. Those were the questions. And so I took my very first inventory. I stood in front of the mirror, I took my shirt off, and I flexed my muscles, and I turned sideways and stuck my chest out. Now, 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. Now, whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And I failed to share it with my parents, and I wasn't yet 18, so they had to sign for me. my mother just about died. My father said, son, you sure you want to do this? I said, Dad, I've been thinking about this a long time. An hour and a half I was thinking about it. So he signed it reluctantly. So my mother was just, God rest her soul, she was just beside herself. And all night she cried. I could hear him in there. And she kept saying, Scott, they'll kill him. And my dad kept saying, don't worry, Pat, they won't take him. So with that vote of confidence, next morning we got a taxi cab and went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a Greyhound bus and I went to Pittsburgh, which is 60 miles away, which is the second longest trip I'd ever been on. And it was a bad year and they took you if you had a pulse. So that afternoon I was sworn in the Marine Corps, and I was terrified. I had no idea about the Marine Corps. The only thing I knew is they took a certain number of men down to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp. It's the only thing I knew about the Marine Corps. And I also thought I couldn't ask. You know, there's something about this pride, this alcoholic pride, that I'm supposed to know what's going on. And if I don't, I'm not supposed to ask. So I learned a trick early on. I learned to do things that you did. And I did them so quickly, it looked like we were doing them together. And so I was always watching. And so the three other guys from the Pittsburgh area joined, and they said, we're leaving that night at midnight, go to Paris Island. And a guy said, hey, kid, he said, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a few beers. I said, that's just what I was thinking. And so I went with him and went over to a bar. And I got to tell you about this bar. I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but the place was filled with real men, you know the kind, and they all had tattoos and stuff. And they all had women with them. Real women. Real women hang around with real men, and guys like me used to get what was left. And I just went in, and I sat down, and the bartender came over. He was a real man. He said, what do you want? And I thought, oh, my God, a quiz. That's the way I felt about life. Like when you least expected it, somebody is going to say, take out a blank sheet of paper. And you know, put your name in the left-hand corner. And then they ask you a bunch of questions, you know. And I studied all the time. I just never studied the right stuff. So I didn't know how to answer this question, like, what do you want? So I watched the other guys, and they ordered a beer, so I did too. And then the guy came back, asked the same question. I watched them. They ordered a beer, so I did too. He came back the third time. I ordered first. I'd become a leader. Somewhere between the second and third drink, my life changed. I remember I stood up. I didn't mean to. I just couldn't keep from standing up. And sort of exploded out of my chair. And I looked down, and the floor was 6 feet 4 inches below me. And, you know, my shoulders were out. And muscles were rippling through my body. And that mind that had been filled with doubt and fear and everything, it was like a bolt of lightning went through my brain. And all of a sudden, I understood the big picture for the first time in my life. And I remember thinking, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? And then I looked around and my heart broke because the place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. You know? And they all had women with them looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. Now, my sponsor, Tom I, said to me, he said, you know, you could have quit drinking then. It wasn't too late. I said, Tom, who would have wanted to? And I spent the rest of the night going around the bar just explaining life to people. It was incredible. They had so many questions. And it came time to leave. It seemed to me, now this may not be entirely accurate because I had about 20 beers, but it seemed to me that they were saying, please don't go. And I said, no, I have to go and make the world safe for democracy. We went and got on the train. Now, I assume we got on the train because I woke up on the train. And I woke up on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had provided for me. Someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was, he had wet me too. So I changed my clothes and I got off the train. We're in Washington, D.C. It's three times as far from home as I'd ever been in my life. And I was terrified again, but I knew what to do. I knew what to do about being afraid. I got off the train, and the guy said, what took you so long? And I didn't bother answering them. They said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to find a drink. And I did. Early the next morning, I began to drink. And that evening, I fell off the train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. But somebody moved the bottom step or something. I fell across the railroad tracks, and it was a very rude man they'd sent to greet us. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up, and I tried to explain to this Cretan he'd get along with us a lot better if he treated us with a little respect, and he didn't seem to grasp, very limited man. He didn't seem to grasp exactly what it was I was trying to say. And they say you can learn from any experience, and what I learned that night was you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned that night. And in case you're interested, you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. And the next day they put us on a bus and took us to Paris Island, and I got to tell you, I absolutely loved it. I loved the insanity. I loved it from the first day, and I made up my mind that I would stay in the Marine Corps for 100 years if they let me. I mean, I got out of boot camp. I won Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award. It was terrific. I mean, you know, how compared to the nuns, the drill instructors, you know, they had a lot to learn. And you know, there was more room in a barracks than there was in the house I grew up in. I mean, I loved everything about it. And, you know, I went there. I was a skinny little kid, but I could do 250 push-ups before I went. So I would always act like 100 were a lot. You know, I'd strain and all this stuff. And I could have given them another 100. I mean, when I got there, and, you know, I packed on about 30 pounds, and I grew a few inches. And it was incredible. And I loved it. And every promotion I ever got was a meritorious promotion. And I was first, second, and third in every class I ever took. And I worked hard. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps one time, and I worked very hard. I was going to be commissioned before the guys I went to high school with graduated from college. And I got my appointment to go to Officers Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia. And in 1965, I went down to Santo Domingo. And I made a couple of things. I went to Cuba during the Missile Crisis, and volunteered to go to Vietnam in 63 and 64, but they wouldn't take me because I was a teenager. They said, we can't afford to have teenagers killed over there. They sure changed their mind later. But I was in Santo Domingo in 65, and I was supposed to come back from there, sign my extension papers, and go to OCS at Quantico. And when I was down there, I led a patrol into combat in a blackout. I woke up one morning, and I was fully clothed. I was in my tent. Last thing I remember was opening the second bottle of rum the night before. I led a patrol every other night, because I have excellent night vision. And the night I didn't lead the patrol, I began to drink when the sun went down. And the night I led the patrol, I began to drink as soon as we got back. And evidently, the man who was supposed to lead it got sick, and they came and got me. And I don't remember getting up. I don't remember getting dressed. I don't remember going into town. When I woke up, there were 3 rounds missing out of my magazine. There was a round in the chamber, and the hammer was back in my .45, and I almost never slept like that. And I was terrified. And I was supposed to go explain to the captain what happened on a night before, patrol before, when he took fire. And by the grace of God, nobody was hurt, but I was terrified. So, you know, I had to fish enough information out of the guys that went with me to tell the captain. And it was like, what was your version of what happened last night? And I came back, and I turned down the appointment and finished my time and was honorably discharged. But you know, alcohol cost me the first thing I ever really wanted in my life, and that was that career. And that was it. I mean, I'll tell you, my history of alcoholism is basically this. I'd fall in love with a way of life. And gradually or not so gradually, I'd violate every tradition, every principle associated with that way of life. And that's what I did in the Marine Corps. That's what I did as a married man. That's what I did as a father. You know, when I was, my first daughter was born, Kelly. God, I loved her. And all I ever wanted was a daughter. And she's the sweetest, cutest thing, big brown eyes. And I came home one day. She was 4 months old. And my then wife had to go to work. They had an emergency. She worked in an emergency room. She was a nurse. And they had a big accident on the beltway, and they called all available personnel in. And so when I came in, she was running out and said, you know, your dinner's in the oven, and Kelly's asleep. Please don't wake her up. She's sick, and let her sleep, and her food. And she gave me all the instructions. It took off, you know. And then I remembered I didn't have anything to drink. And I started to pace back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Of course, I made the only decision an alcoholic could make. I checked on her, And I grabbed my car keys and I ran out and I jumped in the car and I drove to the liquor store and I grabbed a bottle of gin and I threw the money down and I ran back and I was clutching that to my heart and I was thinking about crib death and about the apartment being on fire and I went running in and just my heart pounding and I looked and she was okay and then the self-recrimination, you call yourself a father and all that. And about halfway through that bottle of gin, I figured out what the problem was. The problem was if her mother had been where she was supposed to be, that wouldn't have happened. And so that woman, after working essentially a double in a bloodbath, comes in at 11 o'clock at night and has to listen to this drunken idiot rave on about what a lousy wife and what a lousy mother she is. And that was my alcoholism. And our second daughter was born. She was almost 3 months premature, and I was passed out on the living room floor watching the test pattern in my underwear, which was one of my favorite things to do. And my wife had to get the neighbors to come in to wake me up, and I was enraged, of course, and I was drunk, and I got her in a car, and I drove her to the hospital I worked in, and I demanded they take care of her. What a joke, and I was drunk, and I had to be a horrible embarrassment to her. And she delivered a little girl who weighed less than 2 pounds, to whom they gave no chance to live, and all I wanted to do was go home. So the first opportunity I had, I ran away. And I just got home, and I got in bed, and I went to sleep, and the phone rang. And my wife was crying. I said, please come back. She said, our baby's going to die. I need you. Please come back. And remember, I was in a rage. I was just in a rage. I was so emotionally and spiritually inadequate and incapable of handling anything. Everything inside of me by this time had died as a result of alcoholism. And I went back, and we had an office across from the neonatal nursery, and I sat in there, and they put her on an experimental machine. The chief resident in the neonatal nursery was a girl I'd gone to high school with back in Ohio. What a coincidence! And she said, Keith, she said, I don't think it'll make a difference. She said, I don't think she'll live, and if she does, she'll be retarded because of the lack of oxygen. But we'd like to try this new machine. Do you mind? And I said, well, do whatever you need to do, And she said to me, you know, it's important that you touch her. It's important that you love her because babies know these things. And she was telling me all this stuff. And you know, when people was watching, I'd go in and do it. But I didn't do it because I thought I had anything to give. I did it because I didn't want to look like I didn't care. But most of the time, I cowered in that office. And the better part of 3 days, the lights were out, and I'd hide in that office, and I'd watch this little thing fight for every breath. I'd watch the woman I was married to walk up and down the hall with a 1,000-yard stare. And I knew what to do. I remember the night, on the third night, which is particularly critical for these hyaline membrane kids, my wife went in and baptized her because they didn't think she'd make it through the night. And I knew what to do because my father was the greatest father and greatest husband I've ever known. What he'd have done is he'd have gone in and put his arm around his wife and he'd have said, Pat, with God, we can do anything. That's how they raised 11 of their own children and a bunch of kids who had no place else to go. That's how they did it, because with God we can do anything. But I was far from God by then, very, very far from God. And I ran down to what served as a chapel in the hospital. I worked at Georgetown University Hospital, as a Catholic university, and I hadn't been in that chapel. Believe me, I hadn't been in that chapel in a long time. And I went in and got on my knees. I was just terrified, and I begged God to let our little girl live. I said, if you'll let her live, I'll do anything. If you'll let her live, I won't drink. And I was drunk in 12 hours. I never want to forget that I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher, said, God created man in his own image, and unfortunately man returned the favor. And I created a God that would kill a little girl because her dad was sick, and fortunately I don't serve that kind of God. She lived, and she now lives over in Alabama, Fairhope, Alabama, and she just had her second daughter, beautiful little girl just like her. She's an honor graduate from Auburn University. I always tell her, I think you can be retarded and be an honor graduate from Auburn University, but just kidding. Of course I had to leave. You know, a few years later I was out of there. A couple years later I was gone. And I went to where I had to go. I ended up living in a Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., in a basement of a house. And And on May the 13th, 1973, I went in to do the next thing, which was to take my life. The alcoholic who kills himself is just doing the next thing. And I'm amazed that more of us don't die that way, although millions of us do. And everything was over. I was gone. Everything was gone. And I went in to die. And I said aloud, you're 29 years old, at least it'll be over. And a voice said to me, it's just starting. A woman's voice. It was very strange. A woman spoke to me and said, it's just starting. And I had a very clear moment. And I'd been drunk around the clock for 2 weeks, and I had a very crystal clear moment. I remember my estranged wife had given me a phone number and said, I can't help you, maybe these people can. And I ran out and I pulled this drawer out and I fell on the floor and I was crawling around sobbing like an idiot and found this number and I called it. And I had no idea who I was calling. And it happened to be a treatment center, an alcohol treatment center. I never imagined such a thing. I just said to them, if you can't help me, I think I'll die. Because I was given a great gift. I knew if I took one more drink, I would die. And knowing I will die will never keep me from drinking. Knowing I will die won't keep me from drinking today. The only thing that keeps me from drinking is a miracle. And the woman knew how to talk to me. She was a recovering alcoholic, and she talked me through it. And I hung up the phone, and I looked, and it was almost a full fifth of scotch on the draining board. And I went over, and I started to pour it out. And I knew I wouldn't, so I stepped back and hurled it as hard as I could, and it shattered in the sink. And if that bottle had bounced, you'd have a different speaker. Because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. And I detoxed for 3 days. I had to go borrow some money to go to this place. And sometime in the second day, I began to hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It's a lovely piece of music, but I put a nickel in a parking meter by the bank, and it started to play, and I stood there and listened. And I was crazy, and finally it was time to go, and I got in a car, and I started to drive. It was 30 miles away, and it took me 5 hours. I had what they used to call the running fits. Now they call them an anxiety attack, because you get to take Valium. But then it was a running fits, and I'd get out of the car, and I'd run up and down the side of the road, and I'd sick, and I'd throw up, and I'd wet my pants. And I'm changing my pants beside my car on Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out. And I wondered what went wrong. What went wrong? And I got to that place, and all I wanted was a place where they'd lock me up where I wouldn't hurt myself or the people I loved anymore. And they explained to me, that's not how it works. And they put me on a bus, and they took me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man met me at the door. He was an eye guy. Looked me right in the eye, you know. And he said to me, he said, you know, son, he said, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again. I wanted to scream at him and say, Mister, you don't know me. I'm a man who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl. But you know, he did know me. He not only knew me, he knew what I had. And more importantly, he knew what you had. And that's the solution to what I have. And they took me in, introduced me to an old lady. She sat next to me and patted me and got me a half a cup of coffee. And halfway through the meeting, she looked at me and said, you know, honey, you keep coming here, you never have to be all alone again. And I began to cry. I didn't know what I was all alone. But you know, I'd always been all alone. The only time life ever seemed to make sense to me was between the second and third drink. I was never a guy fit to live life without alcohol in my system. It never seemed to work for me. And so I was launched into this way of life that's just the most incredible, incredible way of life. I can't imagine living my life any other way. Profound blessings I've had, and a marvelous thing to happen to me. It's a long and a slow and a sometimes arduous task to get sober. But you know, the hardest thing I had to learn about getting sober was it really is not my power that does it. It really is the power of God, and that was the hardest lesson I ever had to learn. I hit the road running, and. You know, every idea I had was wrong. I remember going to a meeting early on, and I'd had a sponsor by this time, and I pull up at an intersection. There's a guy named Art P., very active in Washington, still very active, and Art had a car. There were six of them in a car, and they're laughing and carrying on. And I remember looking over and thinking, that's sad. Art can't even make it by himself. And then I thought, they seem to be having a good time. And So when I got to the meeting, I said, Art, I said, you guys, you always have so many people in your car. He said, yeah, my car won't start unless there are four people in it. And I said to him, I said, well, I got a car. He said, I know. He said, we got an old lady here that we want you to pick up for a little while, okay? And I said, okay. So I pick up the old lady and I take her home, and then I pick her up for the next meeting, and she'd always get in the car and she'd pinch my cheek and say, you're so cute. And then she'd bring me a cookie or something. She's really a nice old lady. And so I'm picking her up and taking her to meetings and everything. And about 2 months later, Art said, look, we got another guy who's going to pick her up. I said, that's my old lady. And I began to understand something about how this thing works. And then, you know, I just sponsor. You know, I learned so many lessons. I learned from the old timers, okay? And you really stay away from the old timers, okay? They are not nice people. Tomorrow night, you'll get an idea. They'll have a countdown, and you look at the old timers and stay away from them, okay? Because the only thing old timers, the only, you know, they don't need to go to meetings anymore, okay? The only reason they come here is to watch you and me suffer, okay? And it's true. And if you don't believe it, after the meeting, go tell them a problem. The first thing they do is laugh. If you really want to make their day, tell them a problem about sex. They love problems about sex. You know? And the answer is always the same. No sex. You know? They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want us to have sex either. But they were always there, you know. And like an idiot, I'd always go to them. I never figured it out. You know, all I'd ever get was, you never get an answer from an old timer. You get a parable. You know, oh, tell them, I haven't slept in 3 days. Well, the earth moves slow, but the ox is patient. Right, yeah. Thanks a lot. I'll get back to you on that. So he never answered questions. So I went to this guy one time, and I said to him, I go every month. I belong to the problem of the month group. And I was sober a few months, and I went to this guy, and I forget what the problem was. Everybody had it in July of 73. It was a big problem. Just swept through Washington. And so I told him, and I talked to him the month before about the fact that I was impotent, which would put a crimp in your sex life. And he told me, oh, you really like that. And he said, it'll get better. I said, when? And he said, what, you got a full social calendar? So then the next month, I got another problem. I go back to the same guy. You think I'd learn, but I didn't. So I go to him, I tell him his problem, and he said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. He said, I want you to borrow some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. He said, I don't want you to do anything else with the girls in the program. He said, well, that's right, you can't. He said, I want you to borrow some lipstick and write on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. Well, I went and bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home and I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And, you know, in the bathroom, I said, these people are nuts. This makes no sense. It has nothing to do with what's wrong with me. So I went off to bed. It was a normal night. Remember a normal night? Oh, geez. You know, like I lay down, my mind wake up for the first time, take off, you know. You're never going to make it, you know. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent. On and on, okay. And then I finally go to sleep, and then the leg cramps would set in. And then I'd go 15 minutes before I had to go to work. I go sound asleep. And it takes 3 clocks to wake me up. And my mind was waiting for me, and it said, you're going to go to work today, you're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, they're going to fire you, what difference does it make, you're hopelessly in debt, you know, it's a normal morning. I went in the bathroom, to, mornings like that, you don't know whether you want to start coffee or fall on a butcher knife, and so I started the coffee, and I went in the bathroom, I looked on the mirror, it said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble, And I discovered that the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is being wrong. And the more things I can be wrong about, the better my life is going to be. Just think if we'd have been right. Oh. How would you like to live in a world if we were right? Oh, gee whiz. You'd have to be drunk to live in a world like that. You know? You know, I things began to happen to me. It was unbelievable. I had a sponsor. His name was Dan. He's a marvelous man. And I tell you, I don't know how people do it. It's, of course, their business. But I hear so much about you have to be sober so long to do this and so long to do that. You know, I was sober 5 weeks when I went to my first institution. I went to the Howard Pavilion for the Criminally Insane at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. And I said, the guys were going, so they took me. And I said, well, what do I say? They said, don't say anything. I said, well, what do I do? They said, well, take cigarettes. They like guys with cigarettes. I said, okay. So I got an extra pack of cigarettes, and they liked me. And that was my first bit of service work. 1 week later, I was in an alert and reformatory, the prison for D.C. I was sober 6 weeks. I was in my first prison. And I've been into a lot of them since then. It's one of my favorite places to be. But they got me involved now. I led my first meeting when I was sober like 2 months. It was really wild. It was at a halfway house. He said, go down to First Street and lead this meeting. Well, what I wanted to do was I wanted to impress them with how smart I was, you know, and how quick. And so I studied like crazy. I wrote out these things on 3x5 cards, and I couldn't remember my name. But I write these things out, and I sit out in the car outside the halfway house, and I'm studying them, right? And so I go in. Now, I want to appear brilliant. So I open the meeting, and I say, my name is Keith. I'm an alcoholic. I said, I haven't had time to think about a topic. See, that's what I was going to say. And then I was going to tell them this thing I've been studying for 2 days. And then I'd be brilliant. And I was very honest. And so I said, I haven't had time to think about a topic. And this old-timer said, then shut up. He said, if you don't care enough about us to study a topic, and we don't need to listen to you babble on. He says, anybody here prepared a topic recently? And this brown nose down the table says, well, I led a meeting the other day on resentments. He said, good, you lead the meeting. He said, there's at least one guy here who needs it. And and I got a letter asking me to come to study in France. A man named Jerome Lejeune, great cytologist, maybe the greatest that ever lived. And I was supposed to go over and study staining technique with him, and I knew I wouldn't be allowed to go. I'd figured this sponsorship thing out. See, sponsors are people who find out what you really want to do and don't let you do it. And I had it figured out, so I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction, but what I did was I showed him the letter, and we were at lunch, and he just beamed. He said, this is magnificent. I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. He said, this isn't about you. This is about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, all you can do is crap your pants over there on Skid Row. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he told me something. If you're kind of new, I hope you'll remember this. I said to him, I said, I didn't think you'd let me go. He said, look at me. My mother used to say that when she really managed her. Look at me. And I looked at him, and he said, never forget this. He said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. You know, this isn't a place where we get part of life or a piece of life. This is a place where we get more life than 99% of the people I know who aren't here. This is incredible. And we had 3 months to prepare. And, you know, on New Year's Eve, 1974, I was sitting in a corner of the plane overwhelmed with gratitude, thinking about 7 months before, I couldn't leave the dive I was living in. 7 months later, I'm landing at Orly Airport, and I'm walking the streets of Paris, a free man, truly a free man. And I met AA members over there and on. It was just incredible. And that's really been the story of my life. If I'm willing to prepare properly, I can do anything that comes down the pike. But I have to be willing to prepare properly. And that means preparing spiritually. You know, again, the hardest lesson I ever had to learn was a lesson that that God provides the power. You know, I went ahead and I went and got a couple degrees, and I became absolutely magnificent. And it's unbelievable. I mean, I was running marathons. I had this incredible social life. I had solved that old problem. And, you know, I'm a vegetarian, of course. You know, you got to be a vegetarian if you're going to get nuts. And, I mean, I was just magnificent. And I'm running all over the country delivering professional talks, and I've begun to be asked to speak in AA conferences, which shows where they were. But at any rate, I'm sober about 6.5 years, and I just fell apart like a cheap suit. And I ended up going to a treatment center. And I didn't drink or take drugs or anything like that. They just didn't know what to do with me. I was just crazy because I had generated everything on my own. I forgot about God. Oh, I went and got a degree in theology in case I ever bumped into him. You know, I wanted to be able to speak God in case, you know, maybe even discuss the scriptures with him. But I had nothing to do with God. It was all about me. And, you know, the people I worked for, the people who worked for me, got together and confronted me with my behavior, my self-centeredness, my arrogance. And a wonderful, wonderful nurse, member of Al-Anon, said to me, she said, you know, you used to go to a lunchtime meeting and you'd come back and tell me something really good that you heard. She said, now you go and you come back and tell me what you said. And it scared me. And so I said, well, what do I have to do? So they said, we want you to go someplace and get a rest and do this and do that. So they put me on a plane and sent me to Texas. You remember Braniff Airlines? Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm on a pink plane. My life's over. I'm going to Texas. Yeah. And I got down there, and I got there in the middle of the night, so I go into this room, and I get in bed and everything. Next morning, I'm so depressed, I can't get out of bed. Now, this is the magnificent one who hadn't had a drink, okay? The magnificent one. I can't get out of bed, and so my roommate comes over, a big Texan named Jimmy. He said, partner, you better get up. And I said, I can't. He said, I'll help you. They hailed out there, you know, and so he helped me, and he basically jerked me out of bed, and I couldn't lift my arms, so he's putting my shirt on me. And he said to me, I know how you feel, partner. He said, I came in at night, and he said, I feel a lot better now. I've been sober 6 days. He said, how long are you sober? I said, 6 years. He said, oh, shit, and went over and got in bed. And, you know, finally in a rage, I remember what I had been taught as a kid. I mean, I had phenomenal religious training and education and everything else. And I had a copy of the New Testament, and it's not conference-approved literature, but the guys who wrote the book read it. And I, in a rage, I was so angry with the God that I never paid any attention to, and I jerked that thing out of the nightstand, and I said, let's see what you have to say. And I opened it up, and it said, don't let your heart be troubled. And you know, my heart had always been troubled. Always been troubled. It said, have faith in God, have faith also in me. And then went on to say that there was a place prepared for me. And I began to weep like I never wept in my life. You know, I've always been a stranger in the world. I never believed there was a place for me. I spent my whole life straining and struggling in an effort to belong, to deserve to be. You know, if I were standing in a spot and somebody came to me and said, that's my spot, I'd move. I just knew that it wasn't mine. And that's when it turned around for me, because I finally realized what it said at the end of chapter 3. I don't have the power. Only God does. And I launched in a program of recovery unlike anything I'd ever been accustomed to before. And I really tried to put God in the center of everything I did from that day until this. And I'm not very good at it, but I'm working at it. You know what happens to us in this program is magnificent, and the results are magnificent. You know, his father that I had who never told me he loved me, that's what was wrong with me. It's either that or mother had a square nipple. I couldn't figure out exactly what the problem was. There was some serious, serious psychological damage done to me. And I attempted to make amends to this guy on several occasions, and I just couldn't do it. And, you know, one day I'm down in, had a little house in a beach house in North Carolina called CZ Does It, which I thought was clever. And my parents had never seen the ocean. You know, when you raise 11 kids and you don't have any money, you don't go on a lot of vacations. And they'd never seen the ocean. So we took them down and they just fell in love with it. So I asked them if they'd keep an eye on my house for me, and kept an eye on it for 6 years. It was wonderful. And I'd drive by there and spend time with Dad. We'd sit and talk. And Dad told me one day we're just sitting there, and I kept trying to make amends, and I didn't know what I owed him an amends for. I thought it was because I was nuts. I mean, you know, I was, God, you know, he didn't know what country I was in most of the time. I mean, I was just a head case, and I thought that's why I owed him an amends. And I discovered it. We were sitting and talking, and he said to me, he said, you know, he said, remember the first day you went to work, And I said, well, I remember my first job. I was 12 years old. I worked in a bowling alley down in Bridgeport. He said, yeah. He said, remember? He said, I took you to lunch. And I said, I don't remember that. He said, yeah, I took you down to Louis' hot dog stand. And he said, you remember what you had? And I said, well, I'll go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog? And he said, yeah, you loon. Always call me a loon. He said, you remember what you drank? And I said, well, I probably orange pop. I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day. He said, that day you drank root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you how to do a good day's work for a good day's pay. My father was telling his little 12-year-old son how to grow up. And he said, you know, he said, we walked down to the bus stop, and I said to you, son, do you want me to ride down there with you on the first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back. He said, from then on, you never let me do anything for you. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them. And he said, you didn't even let me help you go to college. You did everything on your own. And I thought I was supposed to. But I realized why I owed my father an amends. I owed him an amends because I didn't let him do what he did best. And that was be a father. And, you know, about a week later, I stopped by and said, Dad, could you loan me $1,000? He said, yeah. And they loaned me $1,000 and I put it in the bank. You know, and then a little while later, I gave it back to him. And from then on, we were like that. You know, I had the great privilege in the year 2000 of speaking at Founders Day. And after Founders Day, I went up for a family reunion. And then the following week, I spoke at the West Virginia State Convention, 2 miles from where I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia. And my father came and heard me speak for the first time. And by this time, he's pretty old, and he's lost control of his bladder. And so he had a real long T-shirt on, and my sisters gave him. And after I spoke, he came up to me, and he had tears in his eyes, and he hugged me, and he kissed me. And he said, I'm so proud of you. He said, I'm so grateful for what you do for so many people. And then we were absolutely in love with one another. I can't think of another way. And he loved Julia so much, And I went up to see him a year ago in October, and he was pretty sick. And we went up, and he got out the pictures. You know, and I remember one of the pictures he showed me was his high school championship baseball team. And I said, Dad, I heard you were a good ball player. And he said, I was okay. I said, I heard you were all state. He said, well, yeah. I said, was it your senior year? He said, well, actually, all 4 years. And I said, I said, a guy told me years ago that you were offered a professional contract. Is that true? He said, yeah. He said, but it didn't make sense for me. He said, both my mom and dad were sick, and they needed me, and I had a job in the factory, and they needed something for sure. And I said to him, Dad, why didn't you ever tell me how good you were? Listen to this answer. He said, well, you and Denny worked so hard at being good ball players that I didn't want to say anything that would discourage you. I said, Dad, I've been going to meetings for 28 years to try to learn to think like that. Yeah. You just do it. You know, in December, Julia and I went back up because the time was very close. And we were with him, and some of us were around his bed. And I whispered in his ear that it was okay to go. He'd lost his wife for 56 years, 5 years before that. And my brother Terry had passed away. And I said to him, why don't you go see Mom and Terry? It's okay to go. And I made him a promise I've kept. I told him, I said, I'll pray for everybody that you pray for, because he prayed for everybody. He's a real man of prayer. And I held his hand. And we prayed the Hail Mary, which is a prayer he loved. And then we prayed the Lord's Prayer. When we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and went home. And I left that room and I looked at Julia, and I was just choked up. Not so much at the loss of my father. It was a great relief that he stopped suffering. But what I was choked up about was, I said, I'm not supposed to live like this. I said, I'm supposed to be down the street trying to get drink up enough courage to come here. I'm not supposed to live like this. Of course I am. I'm supposed to live like this because nearly 30 years ago, he made me a promise. You told me if I kept coming back, I never had to drink again. You told me I never had to be alone again. You know, I've never had to drink. And if I've been alone, it's been my doing. Self and ego gets in the way and crowds out God and crowds out you. by the grace of God, I haven't had to get so sick that I had to drink again. Been close a few times. You know, I moved into Fayetteville, North Carolina in 1980 from Washington. And I was sober almost 7 years. And I was overwhelmed when I was just sitting on a balcony. I had this little apartment in Fayetteville, and then I had the little beach house down in Wilmington, Carolina Beach. And I was sitting out on a balcony, and I was reading a big book and a big book. And I had this love affair with God for about 6 months. I had that profound experience. And I absolutely felt the presence of God like it talks about in our book. And I said to him, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me?" And I thought back to when I was in that treatment center, and I called that poor woman that I abused so that I was married to. And I called her up, and I said to her, I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up. You know? And here I am, 7 short years later, absolutely filled with the love of God. And I said, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me?" And he said, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And what I know is that what Alcoholics Anonymous has provided for me is a life that he always wanted for me. And I'm so very, very glad that he picked you to deliver it to me. Thank you.